Hello, everyone. Welcome. It's always a joy to be sitting in this field of wildflowers. Tonight, my words will also include some sneezing and coughing and nose blowing and stuffed up nose. I have a cold. I think it's the first cold that I've had in 2 years, actually. Because with all the, you know, precautions and social distancing and masks and all of that, there haven't been any colds circulating. But I've heard that in Paris in the past 2 weeks, lots and lots of people have had this cold. And even in the retreat, I set a retreat. Yes, Lisa's saying, yes, I've had other stuff. I did. I had COVID, so, but I sat a retreat this weekend. There were some other people there, Jan and Joa and Lisa for part of it. And there were some people there who either had the cold or I heard sneezing and coughing, so probably they had it too. I'm not sure that I caught it there, but in any case, that's part of the Buddha Dharma at every moment, and tonight it's in the field of wildflowers with us. So yes, I mentioned that I sat this retreat this weekend, and I emphasized the sat because I did nothing but sit, which is very unusual for me. No talk, no interviews. I didn't do Samu with the group. I did Samu in my own house. I was sitting it was at the Dana Center next door. And I think it's the first time I've sat a retreat there for 15 years. So it was very special, strange in the beginning. I didn't quite know where to be or how to be. And then I just settled into just this right now and thoroughly enjoyed just sitting the whole weekend. Of course, there were ceremonies for transmission from Roshi's most recent successor, Scott Williams, that I participated in. But even these ceremonies in the Zendo, I arranged it so that two of my Dharma brothers, Frank Roshi and Michelle Sensei, officiated, so I didn't even do that. And it was very special to just sit, because even 15 years ago, I think I didn't just sit. I was always the Jisha, I was living in the house, so there was all kinds of stuff I had to do. The Dyson line was in my bedroom. My son was sleeping in what was actually the transmission room this weekend. I was always doing something. But this weekend, I did nothing but sit and enjoyed being there with my old comrades who, you know, like Jan, who I've known for years, and with Joa. And Lisa came, but then all of these people who I haven't sat with for a long time. And I mention that because, like I say, I first felt maybe a little unstable, not knowing quite where to be or what to do or who I was there. And then I tried to just fade into the woodwork, just be another person sitting there in the Zendo. Probably it didn't work because everyone knows that I'm a teacher and, you know, not just, they think I'm not just like them, but I am, you know, so. And when the server came to serve me, I bowed and I held out my bowl I ate what they served. I cleaned my bowls. I did kin hin. I didn't even leave the zendo during the fast walking. I stayed in the zendo all the time during the kin hin periods. I felt like I had nowhere to go. Of course, I could have gone next door to my house, which is right next door, but I didn't. And there was something very liberating in that. Nowhere to go. Nothing to do but just this. And when there was a ceremony, I participated. It was very joyous to celebrate another transmission. So not long ago, we celebrated Joa's transmission. A few weeks before that, we celebrated Tanya's transmission, and now we celebrated Scott's. And Scott told us that, and I think I probably knew this, but I'd forgotten, that he actually came to the first retreat we met him at in the north of England in 1997, because Joanne had posted something on the internet. And this was in the early days of the internet. And here's Joanne here with us tonight. And Scott came because of her. And there are all these things that we don't even think about. But if we just do what there is to do in the moment, Joanne, I don't really know what her motivation for posting that on the internet was, but she just did it. She wanted people to have this opportunity to practice, I'm assuming, Joanne, right? I mean, and she just did it without any ulterior motive. She had no idea that a future successor would be attending that retreat. This kid from Liverpool who was like a, you know, university student. None of us had the idea either. And when I was just sitting there during the weekend, I could return to that, to just doing what this moment presents, just being present for what this moment presents. I don't mean to say by that when I'm giving talks and interviews and organizing retreats, I'm not doing that. I am doing that, but the circumstances are different. Tonight I'm giving a talk and I have a cold, so it's different than last week or next week. Different circumstance. And this is really what our practice is for all of us. We have this koan from the Blue Cliff Record where a monk asks Tozan, who was his great master, when cold and heat visit us, how should we avoid them? So immediately we think that, right, we should avoid it. Tozan said, why not go where there is neither heat nor cold? And so the monk says, well, where is there neither cold nor heat? And Tozan says, when it's cold, kill yourself with the cold. When it's hot, kill yourself with the hot, with the heat. When you're called to just sit. When you're called to be the Jikido, you're the Jikido. This weekend, Jan was a server, and then he was training to be the head server, and he just did it. Joanne just posted that thing on the internet. I just have a cold, so when I have to blow my nose, I blow my nose. When he says, kill yourself with heat or kill yourself with cold, what do you think he means? You know, anybody have any ideas? Like, what does he mean by that? Before I start blabbering on. Freddie looks like he wants to say something.
Be the cold?
Yeah. Be the cold, meaning don't make a separation between you and the cold, or don't make a differentiation between cold and heat. Be the cold is, you know, it's a big concept. At the same time, Can we melt into the cold and not resist it and try to make it something else? Of course, we heat our homes and we put on warm clothing, but that's part of being one with the cold, of killing yourself with the cold. I could probably take medication that would stop my nose from running, but it seems almost superfluous because this is a Zen practice. Having a cold is a wonderful Zen practice, actually. So when we try to avoid them, oh boy, we open the door to all kinds of struggles. If I had sat there during the weekend thinking, I really want to be giving a talk, or I want to give interviews, or I don't want to just sit here, I want to do something, I would have really been suffering. I would have caused myself a lot of anxiety, maybe, or my mind would have been running all over the place. I would have been distracted, actually. And so I just settled into just this. And it was a beautiful practice. Brought me back to this is the essence of it anyway. I don't mean to say that I don't practice this way at other moments, but we forget, I forget like everybody else. And I've become used to doing things in a different way. And at one point Roshi said to me, Sada, how are you? And I said, great. And she said, just sitting, huh? And I said, yeah, it's great. It's great to have that opportunity. And not even have it be my house anymore, because for 7 years it was my house. And I think all of us who sit there still feel like it's our house, but our collective house. Whereas before it was the collective house, but it also was my personal house in the sense I lived there. This morning I gave my writing workshop students a proposition to write, which was to start from some personal event, birth, a birthday, first communion, first day at work, last day at work, some personal event, really personal. This is my life, this is whatever. And to zoom in on that, and at the same time then expand the view to include what was going on around in the world at that time. We were inspired by James Baldwin, an American writer who did that in a collection of essays. But and I was encouraging them to do this because it's all interconnected. It's like we all could, first of all, I gave them the exercise to write about 9/11. I said, September 11, 2001, write for 10 minutes. And everybody pretty much included their personal thing, how they had experienced that day. One of the women was only 9 years old that day. Someone was in Washington. Somebody else was, various places. And they each told about their personal experience of that day. And the texture and the depth of the writing is very different when we do that, when we include both the personal and the impersonal. So I then reversed it and I said, okay, you take a personal event. First I gave you a universal event. Now you take a personal event and you do the same thing. And it helped them, although of course they don't know anything about Zen, but my writing workshops are always Zen writing workshops too. They don't know that, but So I helped them to see the interconnection of it all, of an event that happens here and the interconnection with an event that happens somewhere else, and something that is collective and universal and something that is personal. You know, there was like a guy who wrote about, he was supposed to go to a meeting for, he had just written a play and he was supposed to meet the director. And it was August 30th, 1997. And before he left, he heard on the radio that Lady Di had been in, was, you know, almost dead. She'd been in a terrible car accident. And so he wrote his whole text between these two things, about Lady Di and about him and his meeting with the director and what he was feeling. And someone else wrote about the birth of a child on May 8, 1981, which is the day that François Mitterrand was elected in France, which is a big historic marker in France. And yet for her, you know, the crowds were in the streets, joyous, cheering. For her, the happiness and the joy was the birth of this child. And she wrote, she included both of those things in the text, and it made the text even stronger because of those things. So can we do that in our practice? Can we kill ourselves to the heat, meaning not separate ourselves from it? Be it, as Freddie said, at the same time, including whatever is there in the heat, you know, the windows open, noise in the streets, sweat running down your forehead, whatever it is. Could be fires in the forests because it's so hot, especially now. Whatever it is. Could be taking a dip in the lake because it's so hot. Include it all. Let it all, let the whole world come roaring in, something like that. You know? And we're familiar with this because this is what we do with our wildflower practice. Wherever we are, we make that our zendo, because we don't have a zendo. And with Zoom now, for the past almost, you know, year and a half, more than a year and a half, this has become our zendo. And it's not the same as when we all sat together in the Morvan for the retreat, or this weekend when I sat with people physically. It's not the same circumstances, but it's the same practice, just different circumstances. And as we say, are you willing to make your circumstances the field of wildflowers? Because your circumstances are the field of wildflowers. Your life as it is a field of wildflowers. There's an expression in English, I think it's wake up and smell the roses or something. Isn't that Debbie? Do you know that expression? Something like that? More or less, yes. In any case, it's wake up, smell what's right here. And catch yourself when you see that you're trying to avoid what's right here. Remind yourself that you don't have to avoid it. In fact, your liberation is not avoiding it. The image of Kanzion, you know, the Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is the one who hears the cries of the world or sees the sees the suffering of the world or something like that. And all of us are going about distracted in our lives, not seeing, not being aware of the field of wildflowers and trying to avoid the heat and the cold and trying to not have a cold. And fortunately, we have this, you know, Avalokitesvara Kanzion, this Buddha of compassion, which who manifests, you know, all over the place. So, you know, bodhisattvas manifest all over. Fortunately, we have those people, those beings who are listening, who are paying attention when we're distracted. And thanks to them, we can pay attention too. We can see that example, and they can't see for us, but by them seeing us, like Roshi told me when I started teaching, you have to meet people where they are. We have to meet people, we have to meet life, we have to meet ourselves where we are. There is no other place to do it. If we try to avoid it, we miss it. That's still life, that's still it, but we miss it because we're thinking about other things. What's there? I came across this little piece of paper that I found in the book that was from Chekhov, Anton Chekhov, the Russian writer. The golden moments pass and leave no trace. And then on that same piece of paper, I had wrote a quote from Jung, the psychoanalyst. We meet our destiny on the road we take to avoid it. Interesting, huh? The golden moments pass and leave no trace. So we better be present when they're here because they're not going to leave any traces. And we meet our destiny on the road we take to avoid it. Which means it's the same road. The road we take to meet it and the road we take to avoid it is the same road. It's up to us to meet it or avoid it. I don't know when I wrote that down on this piece of paper. It was in a book, so. So, does anyone have anything to say? Does this evoke anything for you or resonate or questions? Gives me the opportunity to take a drink of water. Jan?
Unmute. Yes. What came up to me was during the year of 2000 that in the Zendo there was no heating system at that time. And I remember a very, very cold winter. And the cloisters were freezing to death underneath the bridges in Paris at that time. And when we were sitting there, there was a cloud of breathing in front of you. And I remember feeling so cold that there was no avoiding anymore. So when somebody stepped through the space, I could feel the wind moving through me. And I was just like the cold. And then Michel Roshi was preparing the meal, and unfortunately he dropped all on the stairs, bringing it up, and we had to wait quite a long time before we had to eat. And I remember then that the whole space, the whole everything there was like a meal every moment. I was waiting for a meal, but it was already, it was very special to become one with this. I was just knocked down by it, or I don't know how to say it. It was, yeah, it was so strong. Yeah.
Beautiful, huh? Wonderful. Mm.
Yeah.
And it often happens like that when you don't have any choice. You know, like you say, just you were knocked down.
Yeah.
It was very cold in those days up there.
Yeah.
Very, very cold. Beautiful. Debbie?
This is a little bit complicated, but I'll try to simplify it. And it's just, it's a silly thing that happened on the way to, or a funny thing that happened on the way to the retreat. I went down with Catherine and we were talking about retreats. And I think that this was her first long-term, not Zen retreat. So she was kind of, you know, what's it like? And I was sort of being a positive advertisement for retreats. And saying all the kind of magical little things that happen, like what you were mentioning about the connection between Joe and Scott. There's so many things like that for me, in any case, during a retreat, just little things. A word comes up that you, and you have the same conversation with somebody else. So we're going, we stopped to get some food in El Dorpo. And actually, I can't believe this now that I think about it. I wanted some ice cream. So there was Ben and Jerry's, and I can't stand cookie dough ice cream. I can't stand the notion of putting cookie dough in ice cream. To me, this is the epitome of American yuck. You know, they just stick their head in food and they don't even cook it. They just imbibe it. So Catherine didn't want ice cream, but I did quite a long sermon about cookie dough ice cream. Then we get to the retreat. And Frank does his little story about cookie dough ice cream. I did not say anything. I mean, she didn't ever mention it. And the way back, we got on totally different subject. But when it was happening, I thought, this kind of thing. This, for me, is the magic of sashimi. That somehow everything is connected to everything. You have these little bubbles of pleasure or something.
And the fact is that everything is always connected like that, but we don't pay attention, so we don't see it, but it's true. La?
Your talk today reminds me about that retreat that you asked me to be the cook, and I have never cooked in my life. Yeah. Some of you remember that, you were there. So, yeah, just to cook time.
And you accepted.
Yeah.
Even though you had never cooked in your life, you accepted. And that's a beautiful thing. And you had a lot of help, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was doing.
But I don't remember the food being bad or anything. I mean, I think it was perfectly fine, wasn't it? Does anyone else remember? It was.
Oh, I remember because I was coaching Lara, and it was a fantastic teaching for me. Seeing her, and I will always remember in the beginning when we were, I was saying to her in the beginning, you know, when she arrived, I said, you know, familiarize yourself with the kitchen and see what open everything and just be familiarized with the whole environment, and then it's like, look at what you have, also the products, and what can you do? And I started, you know, saying, okay, we have 2 hours, and, you know, and she turns to me and she says, just be aware that I've never cooked in my entire life. And I saw you doing it, Lara, and I do remember one day, it was very, very funny, when you cooked pasta, you remember?
Yes.
Yeah, I cooked the pasta like hours before, like 3 hours before, and so all the pasta was like super soft, and she's like, was totally overcooked. And she said to me, what can I do? I said, well, at that stage, there's nothing much you can do, you know? And what you could have done is you do the pasta before and then you reheat it at the last moment in hot water. That you can do. But then you served it, Lara, you just served it as, it just ended up being like a pile of pasta, totally compact. And I actually thought to myself, it's actually really good. You had like turned it in such a way that was actually really, I really liked it. I thought, oh, what an idea. So out of it, you know, sometimes it's like discoveries happen also. So no, I do not remember the food being bad. I was just remember, oh yeah, that's actually very interesting. And also very courageous. Because anyone who cooked in the kitchen for 30 people know how difficult that is to be just on time, right amount. It's chapeau bas, as we say in French.
And that's why I say the fact that she said yes is more important than how the food was or whatever else happened. She said yes. I asked her because I knew she would say yes. Or I thought she would say yes, let's say. I trusted her. And I trusted that she would open herself to it entirely. Yeah.
And it was also a misunderstanding because, Roshi, you thought that she had cooked previously. And I thought she had been in the kitchen.
So, well, and I really like this story that Geno Roshi tells of when she was a student with Genpo, and there was some amazing cook in the Sangha who, she actually had a restaurant and she made these fabulous vegetarian meals in Orioki. And just beautiful food. Everyone loved it. And so it was a long retreat. So after a week, Genpo said to Geno Roshi, who was, you know, just Geno at the time, so next week you're cooking. I've had enough of this woman who's cooking. And Geno Roshi, like Laura, had never cooked before. She probably cooked for herself, but she had never done the cooking in the retreat. And she said, oh, Roshi, it will not be good. It won't be anything like, you know, Mary's food or whatever her name was. And Genpo said, I know, that's why I want you to do it. And so she did it. And she said it was horrible. The first meal, a bit like what you say about Laura's pasta, the pasta was overcooked and the carrots were not cooked enough and it was just a disaster, she thought. And after the meal, Genpo came to her and he said, wonderful, wonderful meal. Because the point is not to make, you know, some kind of fabulous, amazing, delicious meal. The point is to give yourself to it entirely, use the ingredients you have, and take the, I think Jan told João, you know, have the sangha in your stomach or something like that. You know, you're feeding these people. And so you put your heart and soul into it. Putting your heart and soul into it doesn't mean making a fabulous gourmet meal. It means having enough food relatively on time. I mean, in the case of Michel Dubois, he fell on the stairs and that time it wasn't on time, but you know, and that's it, the right amount. Same with all of our practice, right? So if you're ringing the bell, if you're serving, if you're So that's all the Zendo stuff. But if you're in your daily life, taking care of your child, being attentive to your partner, fixing the car, whatever it is, you give yourself to it entirely. Heart and soul. And then it's fine. And then it's really pure in that sense. João.
For me, it was also an important moment when you, I was not going to say this, but when you asked me to be Jan's assistant in the kitchen, it was a very special moment for me. How there was nothing else but saying, yes, of course. It was just, yeah. I had no idea how it was going to be or how it was not going to be. I just, yeah, sure. I'll do it. Well, yes, there are all these, let's call them technical aspects, which are important, of course, like amounts, how many people do you have, what time do you have to have things ready, so when do you have to prepare them, you know, all of these things are, it's good to keep in mind, but what I learned during the, if I learned something during that week in the kitchen was, it's not so much about what recipe are you going to do. Are you going to do oatmeal or are you going to do quinoa or how do you cook the carrots or whatever? It's something else which I really can't explain. It's how you do it, but not in the technical sense. It's how you do it, but not how do you cook? Do I cook this like this or like that? It's not about that. It's something else. Another thing I would like, could you please say something more about that quote from Jung? About the road, it's the same road where you meet and where you avoid your destiny or something. What this thing about, it's the same road where both things happen.
Yes, you know, sometimes in our Zen jargon we say delusion is enlightenment, or we say nirvana is samsara is nirvana. And that I feel that that's what Jung is saying in the same way, that the mind that we awaken, that awakens us, that when we are not distracted, is the same as the mind that is distracted. It's just behaving differently. And when we are fully one with being distracted, we're no longer distracted. When we include it, let's say, the distracted mind excludes and the undistracted mind includes. So I feel like, you know, Jung is saying our destiny is, if we're avoiding it, we're not really avoiding it. We're on that road. We're on the road, whether we're avoiding it or not. And there are consequences, right? That's what we talk about, karma. There are consequences to one action and there are different consequences for another action. But we don't know what those consequences will be. Sometimes we see them directly. Sometimes we experience it directly, you know, like Jan tells the story of experiencing the cold in the zendo and waiting for the food to come, there was this powerful experience of being knocked over by it. He wasn't sitting there to have that experience, but that's what happened when he let go and was no longer, you know, wishing it would be otherwise. Joanne posted something on the internet 25 years ago. There were karmic consequences to that, but that's not why she did it. And she didn't know what those karmic consequences would be. And what we're doing here now, we don't know what it will be. But we do know that in our lives, we experience our lives differently when we sit, when we join with others in the Sangha, when we interact with a teacher, when we open to the world, when we open our hearts, we feel that it's different. And yet it's the same world. It's the same road. It's the same, everything is still the same. But we experience it differently. That thing about samsara is nirvana. You've heard me tell the story about that Pixar film. What was the one with the Vice Versa? Right? The Vice Versa film where the girl, her emotions are represented, you know, as little people in her mind, you know, that we see them. And nobody wants sorrow to hang around. The other emotions, you know, especially joy and happiness, they don't want sorrow hanging around. And so they all shove sorrow off, and she gets lost. You know, she gets lost somewhere in the abyss of the girl, little girl's being. And the little girl then in the world is manifesting something is not right in her life. You know, and everyone notices it. And the other emotions also are having trouble because they can't function without sorrow, but yet they don't want her around. And I thought of, when I saw that film, I thought of this story that Mark Epstein tells of a friend of his. Him and his wife were having a brunch with another couple, and he was talking about his book, his latest book, which was about that, was about, you know, samsara is enlightenment. And he was trying to explain it in terms that they would understand because they weren't Buddhist practitioners. And this woman his friend suddenly had this illumination, and she said, "Wow, I see what you mean. I recently was in this therapy group and I was feeling a lot of sorrow and it made me angry. And I acted out and until I realized that when I just allowed the sorrow to be, I was no longer angry. It was peaceful. I just allowed myself to feel sorrow." And she said, "So I see what you mean. Samsara is enlightenment." She had heard samsara as some sorrow. And I thought that was such a beautiful thing. And it reminded me of the movie of Vice Versa, because it's true. You know, when we include, when we don't seek to exclude, then there we are. It's here all the time. It's the same road here all the time. But when we try to avoid it and push it away, we meet a different destiny. We meet a different consequence. I don't know if that answered your question, Joao, but that's what came to mind.
Yes, thank you.
Joanne?
I'm feeling a bit frustrated this evening because I'm really tired. And I've got a lot of brain fog and I've turned the wrong light on and got myself so I can't, you know, like help myself be more awake. And I very much wanted to just thank everybody for being here, for me to join you all. It just amazes me so much. I heard from Scott, and he contacted me and said that he'd named his Sangha Hazy Moon Sangha because of me. And at that point, I couldn't remember him at all. I have aphantasia, which means I don't have any inside vision. So it's kind of the opposite of what you think Zen's all about, because if I shut my eyes, I don't see anything. And that really makes a big difference in learning people's names and faces and remembering events and remembering things. So I feel a lot of things in my body, and I kind of need to be with people in order to process things more. So when Scott told me about this, I felt really sad, because without being near him and seeing him and getting the vibes of who he is, I couldn't really remember. And it was sad, but I was so happy at the same time that such a wonderful thing had happened for him and for all the people that he's with. And I remember it wasn't an online thing. From what I remember, I thought it was something in the paper. I had put something in the paper kind of on behalf of someone else. And then I'd given my personal telephone number for anyone who was interested. And I didn't give it any thought at all at that time. It felt like the right thing to do. And then I was deluged with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of phone calls asking me, oh, tell us what Zen is, please teach us. And the person who'd asked me to just give a contact number, because they were out of the country at the time, they weren't in the UK when this was going into the paper. They'd asked me to put together some little handouts and some information, and to be, they'd given me some idea of how to talk to people on the phone and so on. But it was so many people, and it was even famous people, film stars in America. Their PAs would contact me. This film star wants to know about Zen. And I actually found that really panicky for me, because a big part of my practice is learning how to be ongoing day by day, a very disabled person. And I don't know, you probably will remember anyone that I don't remember, but who knows me from the past. I used to sit in the Zendo with two sticks, and I couldn't get off my cushion because I used two walking sticks. And I also wear splints. So everything that I did in the Zendo was a bit of a mess. I remember I couldn't do Orioki, and I would basically kind of squabble with Gena Roshi. I didn't want to do things because I can't do them. And she encouraged me a lot to keep trying things, even if I couldn't do them properly. And I was so messy. And at one point I had to wear shoes in the Zendo because my feet were too sore. I was doing everything back to front and very wrong. And then this evening, I felt so frustrated that here we are, we're on Zoom, and I'm waiting for a new prescription, so I can't see properly anyway. So tired that it's hard to follow everything. I thought, this is the same road that I'm on. I still struggle with everything. But the practice and the opportunity to be with everybody is such a powerful and, like Deb was saying, magical kind of experience, that it just brings forth its own energy and fruition and presence. And it sort of carries itself. And my experience is that I have a lot of adversity. And if you just trust and lean into that, that is enough. So I kind of want to share just how great it is to really lean into my own difficulties and to be with you people in order to just help me with my sitting, because it's so difficult for me. And also just to share a little bit about how it's been so helpful for me over a very, very long period of time. So don't give up. That's what I feel. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Joanne. Beautiful. Great inspiration, really. Inspiring story. Really nice. And I, when I met you, it was just at the very beginning before you were having really difficult stuff. And we were servers together in Browfoot. And then over the years, it got worse and worse. And you, yeah, I mean, I think it's at, really, I admire you for your fortitude and your just, you know, your presence. Thank you. Well, we are about out of time. So thank you all for your presence and willingness to be here and share and listen and sit. I'm happy to accompany you on this path in this field of wildflowers. So we still have sitting in the mornings and Tuesday and Thursday nights. Everybody's welcome. We will soon have some dates of retreats online primarily. I might just mention, because I keep forgetting, that in April, there is a big multi-sangha retreat. That means Gena Roshi and all of her successors and their sanghas in Belgium. And everyone is invited to attend. You know, attendance is limited. So if you're interested, you need to sign up fairly soon. And so you sign up with us. So each sangha is taking their own registrations. And it's from the, does anyone remember the date? I have it written down. It's from the 8th to the 15th of April. Okay, thank you. I guess we'll do the four vows and end here.